is Nicole Whitney, News for the Soul, life-changing talk radio from the uplifting to the unexplained. And it's a great honor.
You're listening to the News for the Soul Radio Network.
Next on News for the Soul, it's time for the Whole Health Initiative with Dr. Holly. With more degrees than a thermometer, Dr. Holly's PhDs include psychology, natural medicine, herbal medicine, nutrition, and Ayurveda. She's a scientist, professional speaker, and the author of over 20 books. She also sees and works with energy, and she's here to help you achieve complete optimum health. Please welcome Dr. Holly back to News for the Soul.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to January 12th. It's pouring rain here. Hopefully, you're having some good weather wherever you are. Thank you for joining the program. Today, we're going to focus on ways that you can manipulate data so that you can scare the public. If you're interested in that, that'll be our primary focus medically. I'm going to read you a quote first, and then I'm going to follow with some gardening tips and what you can be doing right now from your kitchen for your health as well as for your pocketbook. So let's just start with this quote. It came from an article entitled, "Everyone Missed This One. Vaccinated people are up to 9 times more likely to be hospitalized than unvaccinated people." I was in Global Research. Okay, so I'm going to just read you a component of it. A concerned physician, won't name, convinced her hospital to carefully track the COVID-19 vaccination status of every patient admitted to the hospital. The result is shocking. I'm actually summarizing it as opposed to just reading everything. She detailed her hospital in detail. Her hospital serves a community in which less than 50% are vaccinated for COVID, but yet during the same time period, approximately 90% of the individuals admitted to the hospital were documented to have received the vaccine. These patients were admitted for a variety of reasons, but including and not limited to COVID-19. More troubling is that there were many individuals who were young, many who presented with unusual or unexpected health events, and many who were admitted months after vaccination. As you might expect, the hospital rewarded her for her courage and leadership to expose the truth by firing her. The message is clear. If you speak the truth, you will pay the price. It is imperative that information that doesn't align with the narrative be suppressed. This is why doctors don't speak out, and it's why I had to quit my job in high tech to speak out as well. The only way you can get the numbers is if you vaccinated 9 times more likely. The only way you can get those numbers is if vaccinated people are 9 times more likely to be hospitalized than unvaccinated. It is mathematically impossible to get the numbers any other way, period, full stop. This is known as an inconvenient truth. However, it is important that we don't leap to conclusions. A good part of this effect could be due to a greater portion of vaccinated people among the elderly. I'm in the process of getting a stratification by age to just see how serious this is. They noted in the article there were many individuals who were young, so we'll see what the data says. It does seem odd that a retired high-tech executive is the one doing the research. I'm just doing it because nobody else is. Okay, so just giving that as a lead into my article, that what they tell you is not accurate, that what they tell you is not in context, that what they tell you has been manipulated. So let's go to the difference between relative and absolute risk reduction, which I'm always amazed how many physicians don't know this basic statistic. It is used and manipulated in the medical sciences over and over and over again. MDs are in fact presented with relative risk numbers as opposed to absolute risk numbers. Let's take a given study. I actually took this out of, I have umpteen of these, but I took this out of a Scottish, I believe it was a Scottish study, It's a longitudinal study with a range of 5 years. The study sampled Scottish men who had no coronary heart disease but did have elevated cholesterol, which, I mean, that could be a whole, well, we've done many presentations, and I've written a book on why cholesterol is a myth. High cholesterol issues are a myth. The cholesterol running to the site are the firemen at the site, not the cause of the problem. Anyways, these men had a total of over 252 cholesterol numbers and LDL over 170. I've given you the research study, New England Journal of Medicine. I've given you the reference for it, so you can look it up. So 50% were given statin drug for 5 years, and 50% were not. That would be called the control group. At the conclusion of 5 years, the death from the coronary disease and non-fatal MIs resulted in the control group having 7.9 deaths and the treated group 5.5 deaths. I have no idea. I didn't go into the study and look at how you can get a 0.9 and 0.5 death, but I think what it was supposed to be was percent. 7.9% deaths and 5.5% deaths. So if you look at the relative risk, now listen to the difference here. This is relative risk versus absolute risk reduction. Relative risk is the rate in the control group minus the rate in the treated group divided by the rate in the control group. So you end up with a 30% reduction. Absolute risk is simply the rate in the control group minus the rate in the treated group, which is 0.024% reduction. You got a 30% reduction versus a 0.024% reduction. That is a massive difference, and that's the problem with absolute versus relative death. So as much as I've given you that, what's that? There's another one you can do, NNT, and that's how many you need to treat to get results. In the study that I just showed you, they treated 100 men. They need to treat 100 men for 5 years to make sure that 2.4% don't have an attack. Now, think about it. They're making this is a 20-year-old statement, $20 billion a day. That was around, well, maybe a 10-year-old statement. So in 2008, 2010, I read that they were making $1 billion a day with just Lipitor. So they're giving a drug that's not required that causes all kinds of other problems because it depletes not only your cholesterol, it depletes your CoQ10, so you can't make fuel in the cell. In order to stop 100 men, in order to stop 2.4 from having a heart attack. No wonder they're making $1 billion a day and causing all these other issues for which you now have to take a whole bunch of other drugs. Of course, of course. Now, I'll give you another one. This is an old one. I can't remember the exact numbers, and I didn't stop to figure it out. 1,000 men over 65, 1,000 Caucasian men over the age of 65 put on Lipitor. Now, if you took just the basic 1,000 men, I wish I could find the study or the sample that I took it from. This is years old I got this one. There was 1,000 men. Out of 1,000 men over the age of 65 over a five-year period, you will have 3 deaths. If you put them on Lipitor, the same 1,000 men over 5 years, so comparative control group, on Lipitor or on a statin drug, 2 will die of a heart attack. The relative risk reduction that physicians are told is 30%. You've gone down from 3 down to 2. That's a 30% reduction. But you've got 1,000 people over the range of 5 years. And I think it works out to 0.0028% reduction. That's an absolute reduction. So in my case, you have 30% down to 0.0028, which is an incredible difference. But if doctors are only taught the 30% and don't understand the difference between absolute and risk and don't bother to look at the research, they have no idea. They think, oh, that's pretty good, 30%. That's a pretty good drop. 0.0028. Now, over the years, we've had various independent groups go in and do research, teaching physicians, teaching MDs, the difference between absolute and relative risk, prescription rate on that particular drug that they've been taught about drops dramatically, in some cases over 80%. So you can understand why pharmaceutical companies that want to make money don't want the physicians to know the difference between absolute versus relative risk, never mind know the difference on a given drug. Okay? Now, you haven't taken into consideration, is there other comorbidities happening? Do they have, in addition to cholesterol, they've said in this particular example, the first one I gave you, that they didn't have any cardio issues, but do they have respiratory issues? Do they have diabetes? Do they have arthritis? Are they on other medications? What is their diet like? What is their exercise regime like? Do they just sit in front of the television all day long, or do they actually go out and go for walks and go dancing and do other things? Those things are hugely important. What about their family history? What about the consumption of sugar and alcohol that we have talked so many times about? Are they taking supplements, and are those nutritional supplements that they're taking of any value? Are they synthetic? Do they replicate what's in nature, or do they replicate what is in a laboratory? Are they actually what we've talked about before? Very often your vitamin D3 that says 1,000 mcgs is 60 to 70% vitamin D2 and a synthetic at that. Is it that in nature it looks like the right hand, but in a laboratory when they make it man-made, it looks like the left hand? It's a mirror image. The hand just being an example of a mirror image. So there's all kinds of things that they don't take into consideration when they present data, whether it's on the media, the fake false media, or whether it's to a doctor, or whether it's even in class when physicians are learning how to be physicians. Okay, so now let's apply this relative versus absolute risk to what's currently going on with the COVID and with the jab. The relative risk factor says you have a significantly high level of being protected by the jab. The real number says somewhat different. So let's just look at a few of them. With Pfizer, the relative risk is 95%. The absolute risk is 0.84%. Are you willing to take a jab that has the probability of adverse events, never mind death, when it only protects you 0.84%? The other ones are a little bit higher. Moderna, relative risk is 94%. Sounds darn good. Absolute risk is 1 to 2%. Really? That's it? Gamaleya, 91% versus 0.93%. J&J, the relative even drops down to 67%, and the absolute is 1 to 2%. AstraZeneca, 67 versus 1.3. And I've given you the Lancet article that gives those numbers. So if you want to look up the reference, you can go to that reference there. Remember, any of the articles I give you, and they're all loaded with references that I've cited, you can go to NicolesNewsForTheSoul.com, go into Dr. Holly, and then go into the archived articles. When we do the programs, she posts the articles usually either before or during the program, so you can even follow along on the program if you want. Okay. What wasn't taken into consideration when we're looking at these last five was the risk of being infected and getting ill, nor the difference between cultural groups, African, Asian, Caucasian, etc., nor the differences with different premorbidities. So now we know that 75% of the, and I put C19 viral just so it wouldn't get tagged, deaths, had four or more comorbidities. So those 75% of those who died from the coronavirus had four or more comorbidities. Do you think it was really the COVID that caused it? I'd say it's the underlying issues that caused it. COVID, the flu we've known, and I've gone over studies of this before, and that have shown every year, whether you're looking at the influenza, A, B, or C, the retroviruses, the adenoviruses, the coronaviruses, they will affect 92 to 98% of the people that die from those flus are senior citizens, usually over the age of 75, that have two or more comorbidities, usually diabetes and cardio issues being the two biggest ones. Why? That's the impact the flu has on you. Now, I can suggest why the flu has an impact like that on you, but that's every year, not just this year or last year. That's been studied for years. It's been well known. And in this case, 75% had four or more comorbidities. And yet you're willing to take, you're still willing to take a jab that has that low of probability of either protecting you or causing, preventing your virus from spreading. And again, we'll go into the virus, catching it with a mask. Going to a little sidestep there. Catching it with a mask is like trying to catch a bee in a hockey net or a fly in a football net or whatever. So the mask is of no use. And now we're finding out really the jab is no use either. Never mind the numbers that have died from it. Holy cow, and they keep trying to suppress that. Okay, so because all the numbers, whether the relative risk reduction or the absolute risk reduction or the, those that need to take it in order to have an impact, because the different effects on different populations are also not reported, we also have other issues because they already knew that the low, medium, and high amount of graphene oxide in the jab had different impacts on different cultural races. Again, whether you're Asian or African, or I'm not sure if there's, they go further than that. I know the Asian, African, and Caucasian are taken into consideration, and they know that medium, low, and high have a different impact on those. That's huge, and they didn't even bother telling you that. So the big consideration in conjunction with that is how is the virus assessed? Well, we know the PCR testing is 95 to 100% false positives. We know there's 59 different types of PCR tests available because they're testing different fragments of the computer-generated virus. And we know the PCR can't differentiate even between dead and live DNA, RNA, etc. So how are they assessing things? So we don't know whether or not you got the virus or not because they don't have any testing, but we don't even know if it's, well, even if it's not, or if it's computer generated, which most people I think are under the assumption now, it was computer generated because we've got the, we've got the evidence for that. But even a computer-generated conglomerate of fragmented RNAs can actually grow and develop and evolve, just like they can if they start in us. So then we have all the different types that they claim that there's out there, the Delta and the Omicron, et cetera. Well, that would make sense because if it evolves normally, if any virus or computer-generated virus actually evolves, it makes itself more adaptable to the human system, so it becomes more contagious but less impact. Having taken all that into consideration, was any of that reported on the news? Were the bigger numbers reported on the news? Were the relative risk versus absolute risk reported on the news? Was a different type of PCR testing reported on the news? If you go into these studies, do they tell you how they determine that the jab is an impact, has an impact? I mean, some of the studies, 50% to 100% of the people in the control group, i.e. those not jabbed, turned over and were given the option to get jabbed and got jabbed. So now, where's the control group? I mean, there's so many issues that are sideways in these studies, which is why they're demanding that the companies, in particular Pfizer, I think, has been most in the news, to present all the data. And Pfizer's saying, no way, they want 75 years before they present the data, after all the damage is done. It's really good looking at the court saying, no, no, now you've got so many days to, I think one report, if I remember correctly, they had 90 days to release all the information. And what it does is it exposes how many different ways data can be manipulated. This type of manipulating opens up to what's called reporting bias. Reporting bias then impacts on how the data is interpreted, how it's applied, how it's abused and manipulated in the news broadcast that we are also coming to. If you have a television, if you listen to media that is controlled by IT and big tech and the governments and CCP. We've gone over that many, many times. So let's look at the different ways that numbers can be misleading. Say they said, this was another one I came across a month ago, and I thought, yeah, very, very good. I adjusted it a little bit, but say your headlines read that 10% of vaccinated people died versus 50% of the non-vaccinated people died. How can those numbers be misleading? Well, if in the vaccinated group they took 100 people with only 10 that died, that would be 10%. But in the unvaccinated group, there was only 20 people in the group and 10 died. Well, that would be 50%. The groups should be equal. And we see over and over time, no, they're not. They're not random numbers taken from the population that would have, say, a mixed number of age, a mixed number of cultures, etc. They're actually orchestrated numbers in order to reflect different things. And then they report it accordingly, 10% versus 50%. They didn't bother to tell you that there was 100 people in the vaccinated group and just only 20 in the non-vaccinated group. So that was just another example of simple ways that they can mislead the data. And we find that over and over and over again. Another component is taking it out of a different type of context. If normally a 1,000, and I'm just throwing out these numbers to give you an example. If normally 100,000 people die from the flu around the world, and 92 to 98% of those who died are seniors with two or more comorbidities, and we've talked about that many times, and then this year they present the 50,000 have died, and 98% are seniors with two or more comorbidities, then the number has actually dropped significantly. It dropped from 100,000 to 50,000. But if you didn't know that normally 100,000 die from the flu that have and are 92 to 98% are seniors with two or more comorbidities, they only tell you that 50,000 have died this year, and they don't tell you the age, and they don't tell you the comorbidity, then that 50,000 sounds like a huge number because they took it out of context. And we see that all the time. We've seen that right from the very beginning, how they take numbers out of context and present them in a way to scare you. So we know most of the virus information, the PCR information, the jab information, regarding adverse events and deaths have been manipulated in a variety of ways in order to scare you. Now, put all that against the time some scientists have claimed, I think this came out last April or May, and I did give you the reference for it, I'll actually read part of it for you, that heat, forget about whether or not you're taking a drug or a nutraceutical or a tincture or anything else for the coronavirus, heat will kill it. Just simple heat. So I'm going to read this to you. This is a quote. Based off the data, the researchers estimated that most coronaviruses would be almost completely killed after exposures of 65 degrees or higher for longer than 3 minutes. The researchers also noted For temperatures lower than 65, a longer exposure time needs to be used. For example, the coronaviruses may need to be exposed to temperatures between 50 and 55 degrees for 20 minutes in order to be killed. To ensure that all coronavirus particles are killed, it may be beneficial to increase the temperature by 10% Celsius. This would mean heating of the virus to 75 degrees for at least 3 minutes. Holy cow. Now let's take into consideration the coronaviruses have been recognized since 1932. They've been in the medical textbooks. Forget about the journals and what have you. They're in the actual textbooks. We typically have 6 to 7 of them living within us. They're going around every year, just like the influenza A, B, and C, and the retroviruses, adenoviruses, etc. And yet, here we are, 5 degrees or higher to 3 minutes. Holy cow. Was that put in the news? On top of all that, I think it was Facebook that just acknowledged that fact checkers are just opinions. Holy cow. What a pile of crap. But they're using it to control people. We've had actually sent another viral went around of a text or email giving documentation of how in 2009 they actually wrote out the pandemic. It's like, yeah, well, guys, come on. The fact that anybody still believes in this nonsense is incredible. Another one we have, that first article showing that 9 times more are likely to be hospitalized. Among the vaccinated people, we have the retired CEO of the WHO, the World Health Organization, saying two months ago now, that all those who are vaccinated should be quarantined for the next 4 months. Oh, and yet people are still lining up to get their PCR testing. They're lining up to get their jabs. I was like, really, people? Are you not reading what's going on? It is amazing. Okay, I am going to go to my garden article now. Where is it? There it is. Okay. I couldn't get my articles to attach to send them to Nicole today, so I had to copy and paste it. I tried a bunch of different ways. I don't know what was going on. Anyways, you know that food prices have gone up hugely in the last year. They're expected, at least in Canada, to go up another 5 to 7% as what was predicted, according to CTV News. I have no faith in CTV News, like any other of the fake news, CBC, NBC, ABC, whatever. But it has been shown that they have increased in price over the last year quite a bit and expected to go up quite a bit more. Now, why? Farmers are being paid to turn their crops back into the ground, which if that was part of a 7-year cycle like they used to have hundreds of years ago to keep the grounds very nutrient dense, supporting the agriculture, then that would make sense. But they're being forced into doing it intermittently at inappropriate times. So that causes food shortages. We know that the port issues around the world are causing food shortages. We have labor shortages, fuel going up for the truck drivers, so that causes issues. We've got the BlackRock, the Vanguard, and City Street involved in virtually everything and anything around the world. They basically own the world, and they own food production and transportation as well. So in addition to the fact that we've already been promoting for years, is that the commercially grown food is hugely toxic. It may not be GMO, genetically modified food, although much of it is, but even if it isn't, it's got the herbicides, the insecticides, the pesticides, the POPs, et cetera, that are incredibly toxic not only to the plant but to our bodies. So there's even more reason now, in addition to nutrient deficiency, in addition to all that toxicity, now we've got the financial pressure to grow our own food. I'm always promoting, please grow your own food. Get rid of the grass and grow food. Put in fruit trees if you have a yard. Put in berries. Put in vegetable gardens. If you don't have a yard, use your deck. Use your patio. Use your windowsills. Use whatever you can to grow your own food. So I've made, actually, I didn't make this list. I've given you the reference books at the beginning and at the end. Food, 16 foods that will grow from kitchen scraps. So let's quickly go over them because it's easy. You don't have to keep buying the same things over and over again. You can grow them. You can grow them at, not only at home but in your kitchen and over winter, for crying out loud. Best thing for growing over winter that's so incredibly cheap is your microgreens and your sprouts. We've talked about that several times. Microgreens do need, if you're using a windowsill, just get a long, narrow planter and good soil. Microgreen soil in particular is what I use, soil specifically for them. But if you don't want to do that, you can grow the sprouts. Just rinse them every morning and every night in a jar that either has holes in the roof, in the lid, or use a cheesecloth as a lid and soak them, rinse them with water and dump them upside down in your dish rack in the sink and let them do their own thing. And you've got incredible nutrient over the winter. So let's look at some other things. Scallions, spring onions, and fennel. Now, I'm actually going to interrupt myself. With all of these, if you buy organic as opposed to regular commercial or GMO foods, you will have far greater success. GMO seeds, roots, whatever, don't have a high success for regrowth. But if you buy organic, you can regrow again and again and again and again, just like nature always had us do. So take with your leeks, your scallions, your spring onions, and fennel. You can take the end off. You take about a half inch above the root. You put it in some water in a sunny windowsill. Let it root and then plant it. Now, you can leave it in a root. You could actually even put it in a jar, like a mason jar. Put some rocks in the mason jar and put some water in it and then let it root further and grow and develop, and then you eat it. Golly gee whiz. Snip off just whatever you need, whatever time. Okay, lemongrass. To be honest, lemongrass is in this article, and I have never grown lemongrass. I have it as a tincture. It's a very good tincture for various issues in the body, but I don't grow it. But to propagate it, you can place the root in a glass with water. Again, leave it in a sunny position. This one will take actually a little bit longer to start growing its roots, and then you can harvest the stalks just like you do with leeks and scallions. Celery, bok choy, romaine lettuce, and cabbage, you take off the end. And again, you'll put them in a little bit of water. You will start seeing the new growth out of the middle. I pull off the outside growth, say, in a celery, the outside sticks of the celery. They will turn brown and rot. You just pull those off and throw them away. When they get to be about 2 to 3 inches high is when I put them then in good soil. Leave them in the windowsill and allow them to continue to grow. And now you've got your head of lettuce, your head of cabbage, your bok choy, your celery, what have you. After I've put it in soil in the windowsill, depending on the time of the year, I will then put it outside and put it in big pots, and it will grow even more for me. So you've constantly got new stuff growing as you're eating it. You don't have to keep buying. Why would you keep buying when you don't need to? Another one, ginger. Ginger I've talked about a couple times because I think it took me 5 different ways to grow ginger. The way I found, obviously it works different ways for different people, but the way that finally worked for me was I took a piece of ginger that had lots of little knobs on it. I soaked it in water overnight, and then I planted it in a good soil and kept it well watered and in a warm environment. Once it started growing, it actually started growing really fast, then you can start removing pieces of the rhizome or the root. Now, you And what I did was I put it in a pot that had 16 inches across the top, because the rhizome, the part that you want to eat, grows horizontally, not vertically. So you need it spread out. Potatoes, it doesn't matter what kind of potatoes you have. The Yukons, the Reds, the Russes, there's 18 different types of potatoes. When you have them start growing roots, so that when you're eating a potato, you're eating the tuber. It's not a root, it's a tuber. The little white things that typically come out when they've been left a long time, those are the actual roots. So cut an area around that root. I keep them all into a container. When my container gets big enough, I spread them into the garden. Keep them just a little water. They don't need a whole lot. But it's really good to start them in the kitchen. So I have containers in the kitchen that have all these little sprouts with the potatoes growing up. At that point, when those sprouts get to be about an inch to 2 inch high, then I replant them outside in a protected, I'm in the north, I'm in Vancouver, so it's not that cold, but I am in a colder environment. So I keep them in raised gardens that I have next to the house, and they do terrific while doing that. Vancouver area, be careful, because potatoes don't like a lot of rain. So my raised gardens on the patio under the deck do get a lot of sunlight, but they need to be watered because I don't like them just right out in the rain. Now, ones in that family that can handle the rain and that are perennials are your sweet potatoes and your yams. And they just keep growing and growing and growing. And they don't mind more rain, like potatoes tend to be. Don't like so much rain. Also remember with your potatoes, you want to keep hilling them, meaning you want to keep putting soil over them, because if the raw tuber gets exposed to the sunlight, it will turn green, and people say that that's toxic, so you don't want that to happen. Okay, garlic, another big one. No matter how many garlic you plant, always save some, plant them again. They do like to be planted in either February or in October. They love the cold. If you plant them in October, you'll have a great batch for the spring. If you plant them in February, you'll have a great batch of them for August, September. Lots of different types of garlic. Don't forget, garlic has 350 nutrients and 33 sulfur components that help your connective tissue and glutathione. Onions, we already talked about leeks and scallions. That's when you eat the tall part, but the onion is when you eat the root component. So when you start onions, cut off the end of your onion, leave again about a quarter to half an inch, and place in a sunny position. They do like the sun. They do like a moist soil. You can plant them right in the soil because you're already taking off the root. You don't have to place them in water. I'll just put them in a shallow root. And just cover it. Whatever you cut off, just make sure it's covered, it's moist, and it's warm, and you will keep growing your onions, all different types of onions. Mushrooms. Now, mushrooms are different. I always tell people to be very careful. There's like 12,000 different types of species of mushrooms, and I'm not very good at differentiating. In fact, I've never tried to learn to differentiate the toxic ones from the hallucinogenic ones from the healthy ones. So I buy the mushroom components. I put them in buckets with wood pieces and just holes, aerate them, keep them warm, keep them moist, and golly gee whiz, we get lots of mushrooms. Pineapple, you have to cut off a bigger piece. It's what's called the crown. You put the crown into some water, and some people put them directly into soil. I've seen it done both ways, and I've seen it benefit both ways. The only way I had it, and I haven't had much success, to be honest, with pineapple, but the one time I did, I put the crown and about a quarter of an inch in water overnight, and then planted it the next day. I thought that was doing a bit of both, and I did have success with that. Carrots you can do as well, but carrots don't form another root. They form the leaf. You'll get the plant leaf, which of course you can use in salads and what have you, but you won't get the root, carrot root that you're used to eating. Okay? So there's a whole bunch of things that you can continue to do in your kitchen without having to keep repurchasing everything. Right? Incredible. I mean, plants just love to grow. That's what they're designed to do. So my attitude is keep them growing, keep them healthy, and they will support you just like you support them. Okay? All right. I know Nicole sent me some questions. Here they are. Okay, I have to go all over. I've got three different screens with tons of stuff on each screen, so I'm all of looking for things. All right. Number one, we've got Danielle in New York. Is there a safe, healthy way to pull down the paint of oversensitive teeth and gums? Well, yeah, there is. Number one, why are your gums so sensitive? Do you have nerve exposed? What's causing it? Do you have infection, inflammation? What's causing the problem? Well, with a lot of those issues, you can use the oil pulling. Now, for years, I've been trying to tell people, don't just listen to what they tell you on the internet, because it's not, a lot of times, not accurate. When you're doing the oil pulling in Western medicine, herbal medicine, nutritional medicine, you take a tablespoon of coconut oil and swish it around in your mouth for about 15 minutes and then spit it out. When you spit it out, you actually leave a film of oil around the gums and teeth, and that has the highest concentration of pathogenic material. The lauric acid in the coconut is what pulls out the pathogenic material, and you've just left that in your mouth. So you need to rinse your mouth with, I just use a quarter teaspoon of baking soda and a quarter a cup of water, rinse around in the mouth really well, and then spit that out. Now that can get rid of inflammation, it can get rid of infection. To deal with the pain in the process, add in a couple of drops of clove bud oil. Clove bud oil is not only an antimicrobial, so if you've got an infection, it will help with that, but it's also a painkiller. It will help with that as well. Now, if you were to do it with Ayurvedic medicine, they would look at your dosha, whether you're Vata, Pitta, Kapha, what combination you are, and they would use oils accordingly. But in Western medicine, people just all tend to use the same coconut oil because it has the lauric acid in it. Okay? Okay, let's see, what else do we have? Michelle in Ontario, I've suddenly in recent weeks been experiencing sharp pains in the joints of my hands. Nothing I do alleviates the pain. Is this arthritis and what can I do? It could be both rheumatoid arthritis and or there's several different types of arthritis, but I'm thinking probably rheumatoid or osteo. Those are the two most common, but there could be a couple others as well. But what I did is I had osteorheumatoid arthritis that came in my hands really fast, and my hands and knuckles were just, all the joints were distorted and swollen, and it was very painful. And because I see energy and work with energy, I could see how the energy was knotted around my hands. And so I kept stroking my hands like I was combing out the energy. I didn't use one hand to touch the other hand. I just combed out the energy. Now, whenever you have inflammation, you're going to have blocked energy. So it just made sense to me to comb it out, get the energy out, and within 6 months, it was all gone. I never used any medication for it. Now, I have used in my knees and in my back when I had arthritis in my knees and back. And I said all my arthritis was due to all the pharmaceuticals I was put on growing up, but I can't prove that one way or the other. It's just my own personal hypothesis. But I did have arthritis in my knees, my hands, and my back, and I dealt with them differently. In my knees, the way I dealt with them is using Mahanariana oil and avocado oil. So the avocado oil has omega-3, 6, and 9, your pro-inflammatories and anti-inflammatories, in the same ratio that our body has. So I would put clove bud oil into the avocado oil and rub that on my knees 3-4 times a day. When the inflammation was gone or significantly down, then I started using the Mahanariana oil. Now, that's an Ayurvedic, a composition of 32 different oils. Provides all the connective tissue, nutrients for connective tissue in the body. And I rebuilt my knees using the Mahanariana oil. I'm supposed to, twice I was told I would never walk again, twice I was told I'd probably never walk again, and I've never done any of the umpteen, over nine different surgeries. I stopped counting at nine surgeries I was told that I should have, and I walk just fine. I will admit, going up and down ladders does bother my knees. But other than that, my knees are really, really good, and I've never had any surgeries, and that is what I use. The avocado to get the inflammation down with the clove bud for the pain, and then the Mahanariana oil to build back up again. Okay? So hopefully that will work for you, regardless of what the actual diagnosis might be. Helene in Texas. Yes, I've noticed my hair is thinning out a lot this year. What causes this and how can I turn things around? Well, Helene, we've done a lot of programs over the years on hair thinning, growth, et cetera. You might want to look at them because we've done whole sessions on it. So if you want to go into the archives and see if you can find some of those articles, you get a lot more information. But to be brief, number one, adrenals can affect height. Hyper and hypoadrenal activity, which is your stress response, can affect your hair growth. Hormones can affect your hair growth. So, for instance, people, women going through menopause, often if they have an estrogen dominance, they'll have a hair loss. Other things can cause it as well. That's the one that comes to mind off the top. But B vitamins can cause hair loss. Infection in the hair follicles can cause hair loss. Inflammation in the hair follicles can cause hair loss. So there's a number of different things you need to go through to decide, determine might actually be. If you don't want to do the work and the research that I would like you to do, you might want to just try putting avocado oil on your hair at nighttime, on your scalp, rather into the scalp. Now you would do that for 3 nights in a row and then off for 4 nights. And then this is the most common protocol I give people, is once you've got 3 nights on, 4 nights off, then you do it alternate nights. What are you doing with that? Well, if there's inflammation, the avocado oil will help pull out the inflammation. If there's infection, the lauric acid in the coconut oil can draw out the infection. If you have bad bacteria, then the avocado oil can suffocate the bad bacteria. And that is actually why you wouldn't do it more than 3 nights in a row, because you don't want to kill all the good guys as well, right? So you'll do it enough to kill the bad guys, but then you have to let the good guys resurface and do their thing. So wash it out in the morning and wear like a shower cap overnight, because if you wear a shower cap, that will prevent the oil from getting onto your pillows and pillow sheets and what have you, pillow slips. So that would be a very general protocol, but it really, really depends on what's causing the issue, like I say so many times. Okay, let's go down to Brian, maybe, in the UK, sorry. Whenever I look into taking supplements, I get completely overwhelmed. Where does one start on knowing what to take, how much, and so on? And that's a really good question, because I have people so often, when people come in for their first appointment, I always say, bring in all your supplement prescriptions, et cetera, let's look at them. And a lot of them, that they're already gone past the expiry date, so throw those out. These ones are crap, better for the toilet than for you, throw them out. These ones, are half of them are synthetic, so throw them out. These ones you don't even need, so throw them out. And then we look at what the body really wants. And I try and get as much of it through food and nutrient, which, again, is why I go to pushing you always to grow your own food. I do the research on these different products. I look at, sending questions. Where did you grow it? How did you harvest it? When did you harvest it? Sometimes even harvesting before and after the dew gives an entirely different nutrient profile. Once you've harvested, then what do you do in the processing? Does the processing of it actually harm the nutrients we're looking for? How much of it is actually real as opposed to synthetic? So, different nutraceutical companies will put in lots of synthetic stuff because it's cheaper to make and people are looking for cheap products. Well, you get cheap products, you get what you pay for. Crap. So, we've known over the last 10, 20 years, if not more, that just because you're buying a brand or a higher price does not necessarily mean you're paying for higher quality. It sometimes just means you're paying for the label, the name. So, yeah, I can appreciate why you're overwhelmed. I can appreciate the frustration. So you do, from my perspective, you do have to go through the process of understanding what's in and how they're put together, which is why I know when I sell product to clients, I know they're getting a good quality. For some of my products, they actually send me a soil sample every year to show me things like, say, hemp oil. Cannabis is, doesn't matter what kind of cannabis, you know, whether it's marijuana or hemp or what have you, it, and I say what have you because there's so many GMO products out there now, they absorb all the toxins in the soil, everything. In fact, it, historically, hemp was used to clean agricultural soils in many areas. So when you're taking the hemp, and this is a big problem with the CBD oils as well, you have no idea how much toxin that they have absorbed. So the companies I buy from, they send me soil samples to show me that they still have good soils. In addition to which, we have a patented process on how to draw out the oils from the hemp to preserve all the amino acids. Hemp has all your amino acids, both essential and non-essential. But I want them to still be there when I'm giving it to my client. Most hemps don't. Incredibly important. Where does one start? Well, start looking at the research. If you're looking for something, I mean, I don't even know what they sell in the UK. I obviously sell with what's here. Tinctures, on the other hand, I bring in from England. I bring in from Germany. My pine oil all comes from Germany. And I look for brands that, you know, I do research on. But that's, you know, actual supplements, I look for from here in North America. I look for companies. I try to get companies in Canada. I try to get, not all of them are, but I do research to find out how they're growing, how they're processed, harvesting and processing. And, yes, that does take a lot of work. Okay, so I really didn't answer your question for you. I just gave you all the parameters on it. Sorry about that, but I can't take it any further. I've never had Peter in Sedona. I've never had earaches in my life, but in the past few weeks I keep getting them. Don't know why. Often, just putting something like coconut oil with the lauric acid in the outer ear. Don't put it inside the ear. Let the blood take it where it needs to go with all of my added process. You can try things like the coconut oil with the lauric acid. You could try something like neem cream, neem oil. That's a really good antimicrobial. You could put, again, because earaches cause pain, put clove drops into either the neem cream or the coconut oil, and that will take care of the pain but also be an antimicrobial. Another common cause, say, for tinnitus, which isn't an earache but an ear issue, so it could be an overlap of the issues, is a magnesium deficiency. And typically you want the magnesium diglycerate, not the citrate, for that one. Hopefully that gives you some ideas, something to play with, something to work with, other than go to a health practitioner and find out what's causing it. I would say if it's an earache, it's an infection and inflammation. So the coconut oil, the neem oil, and the clove bud oil to take that out. Hopefully that works for you. Okay, it's 12:56. This is Dr. Holly with the Whole Health Initiative. My clinic is called Choices Unlimited for Health and Wellness. As I've said for a long time now, I took everything down from my website. I saved all the articles, and I haven't put up a new website because I don't want to get tagged. I don't go onto Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn because I don't want to get tagged. So I leave this just for you guys. Hopefully, whatever you're looking for, you'll either send in emails to Nicole that get transferred to me, or you get answered on the different programs. And again, don't forget, all the articles, all the programs have been archived. So like 6-7 years worth of articles have been archived for you if you're interested. Make sure you follow through. And all the best to you and your health. Don't forget all the manipulation of data when you're listening to all the fear-mongering that's going on. And don't forget to not get emotionally involved in it. Use your emotions. Use your thoughts, your prayers, your meditations, your imagery to create what you want to come out of this mess of chaos that we're in, hopefully to expose all the black hats and allow the rest of us to maneuver on to bigger and better things. All the best to you in the next week, and we'll talk with you next time. Take good care. Bye-bye.
Hear all of our previously aired broadcasts of News for the Soul online at newsforthesoul.com. Now let's get back to the show.